Would both of you introduce yourselves, please?
Go for it, Rich.
Hi, my name is Richard. I'm in the Buttertones.
And this is Sean from the Buttertones.
But LA 2012 is when you formed this
thing? It might have taken us almost a year before we even recorded some of those songs.
No, we recorded in April of 2013.
Never mind, 4 months.
Three original members, then you got extras, then someone disappeared, then there was disaster, then there was a session musician. See, we're done. There's nothing more.
That's it in a nutshell.
Tell me about the Musicians Institute. I did that in the full announcer voice. The Musicians Institute, because this is where three of you pretty much met. It probably is a great place to learn music, but it also sounds like you could learn computer programming there.
You can learn a lot of things there. You can learn, to go back to the beginning, I think I first learned about that school through an ad in the back of a Rolling Stone magazine.
Seriously? So it is one of those?
There was an application process that you had to, share some music you created. And
well, that's right. I remember. Yeah. I got in.
I was so nervous that, that they were going to listen to it and be like, this guy does.
So they actually don't. So all kidding aside, they actually don't just take your money. It's a real place.
Honestly, I don't think they they value the applications all that much.
Yeah,
it's a for-profit private school, so they'll take anyone willing to apply, pretty much.
What did you get out of it, other than that you met each other, which is good enough, by the way?
Honestly, couldn't really think of a better gateway into just trying to be into the world of professional musicians. It was frustrating, just how many, you got there and you realize,
I'm one of a billion people that are going to have the next big band.
Everyone.
Pretty much.
Just competing egos and who could shred the hardest.
They bonded over mid-20th century music.
We actually bonded over just getting drunk together for a year. And there was a bar right next door. I forget, what was the name of it? So we all became pals, and we all kind of watched each other's performances or whatever, and would share some music here and there, but it was mainly just us being new in town and just hanging out
It was college,
No, I get it. So where was the moment that the three of you were hanging out, getting drunk at the Pig and Whistle, and you said, we don't want to shred like the others. We want to shred like something else. And how did you know?
Well, because for me, we do these things called a
live performance workshops.
Yes. And they wanted you to sound exactly, for me, because I was a singer, they wanted me to sound exactly like Cage the Elephant, or exactly like
The Cure.
Any band,
That was their way of training. That was their methodology.
A wedding singer,
Great. Fantastic, because the world really needs more people that sound exactly like. Yeah.
So we bonded over that, definitely. And, it was all very natural. We all lived very close to each other and just said, hey, let's jam one night. Because we all got along so well, because a lot of, there were some, like I said, those types of musicians, a lot of them were not like that, but we just, got along the best, and we wanted to do our own thing.
Yeah, I think we all kind of recognize the integrity within each other, and we just shared the attitude that this school was hilarious and frustrating, and we were
that's a good thing
to be over it and.
So basically, you got together to get out.
It was how do we get out of this? How do we make it beyond this school? Because there wasn't really a whole social hierarchy at the school. Everyone was just
there were contests where that you could form a little group, and they said, "Oh, the winner, the winner of the contest will get a record deal or something like that.
Oh, yeah. And then the A&R guy shows up. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because it works that way all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was not a bad experience at all. It just, in the end, it was not the place for us, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. If the work ethic really did stick with us, like the faculty was really great.
Looking at doo-wop groups and saying, we're going to name ourselves the Buttertones, that can either be ironic or that could be real. I mean, there's a smile there for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like we kind of just needed a placeholder. Like, we had music and we had to.
And it stuck, though. You didn't get rid of your placeholder. It stuck.
That's right.
Yeah, it did. So, again, and we were just in a bedroom rehearsing for a long time.
And so becoming a household name in Echo Park, Los Feliz, and Silver Lake, what, I mean, you know, you have adoring crowds here, but I imagine you wanted something a little bit more than that. You aspired a little beyond that.
Well, whoever's writing our Wikipedia page might be exaggerating.
Yeah,
It's not exactly like we're paparazzi is not.
Yeah, we can't.
Where's that moment where, number one, you found a label, or did they find you? And was there a manager? Was there all that? You know, all that. Let's get some of the business stuff out of the way.
Well, I mean, it first started with Lollipop Records, which was the local cassette based.
Right.
Record store and studio next to the Echoplex. And we made friends with them and got to use their studio to rehearse all the damn time. And that just kind of created a community of bands our age then. And, you know, you can make a different bill every night of the week with the type of bands that were circulating around town at the time. So, you know, that kind of grew into that kind of got us our first shows in this community. And as soon as shows start becoming available in LA, like the suburban house shows and stuff, the emails just started coming. It's like, hey, play my garage. I'll buy you beer.
Yeah. that was the whole first year of our career. You know, it's just playing in backyards or in a garage or some random ass seafood restaurant. Like,
we had to actually move the tables to play.
Yeah.
How did you get to Innovative Leisure?
Well, I mean, after we started like the local circuit, we were playing these warehouse shows in Cypress Park. This group of skaters known as the Warble had a warehouse out there, and I think they were trying to like, they had to move. It's like a brewery or something lame now. But we were playing these like final shows, every month. It was like eviction show, like come throw down. It's gonna be a huge party. And then the next month, it's like, we're still here. The power's still on. Let's do another show.
And they were a blast too. So
yeah,
they were
some of the most fun shows. Like, I'll remember those forever. There's like, they would do some huge gimmick at every show. Like, one time they built a Trojan horse and like rolled it in mid set, and like while we were playing, and so we like cut the song right at like a climactic point, and a dude bursts out of this wooden Trojan horse with like 60 beers and starts throwing it to the whole crowd, and everyone just gets so hyped. And then we go right back into the music, and at one of those shows, Nate from Innovative Leisure decided to stop by, and I think that's when we first got on their radar. And then actually, same year is when we got our Echo residency and did four nights and four Monday nights in September, and that was kind of what pushed it to the next level, I think.
So where did you, and I asked,
and our producer, hold on, sorry to interrupt.
Mr. Antlers, we're gonna get there. Go ahead.
But yes, yeah, Johnny had a lot to do with us connecting with IL.
So early on he did. Got it. Way before he was producing the records, he was a fan.
Well, we met him because London had joined the band that year. He just showed up at our doorstep. London did. And, you know, we started playing together, and London knew Johnny because they lived in Long Beach and he had been in a studio plenty of times. So
Johnny or London played sax for Crystal Antlers too.
Yeah.
For Got a it. Short time.
So London tells us we need to go do one song with him or whatever. And we're like, oh, well, we're for it. So we tried it out. We loved it and loved the experience. And we just start recording little things here and there, little EPs. And Johnny just starts, you know, getting into Nate and Jamie's ear. And so that with the shows that we were playing, those crazy into the, you know, evicted shows. That's what happened, I thought, from what I remember.
What's the filter for a Buttertone song? How do you know it's your song? Now, you've made 5 albums. We're going to get to the new one in a second. But this is kind of that combo question of where did you know you had something?
We just wanted something. You know, we weren't joking. Or, like, it wasn't a joke. That's why we moved to L.A. We wanted to be artists out there and play shows and just write and record, you know, live the dream in that way. So there were, you know, crappy shows in the first year, but we knew that's what we signed up for. So I don't think any of us ever really were thinking, I don't know, it's not working out or whatever. We were determined.
So you obviously still like this Antlers guy because you've kind of kept him on board for this Jazz Hound thing. But Electrovox Recording, I mean, Holy Toledo, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, Sinatra. You put a lot of, and I think this is what I want the audience to know, is records like this don't just go, oh, here we are. You put a lot of work into this. You put a lot of rehearsals in. Tell me about the work and choice of studio and all the things that it takes to get something that sounds like this. Give me a couple of clues here.
Johnny, it was his dream to record there. And, that's when we're like, yeah, we're going along with you again, you know, going with you again to Electric Box. Because, yeah, like you said, all those different harnesses, very heavy being in there.
Really? Did you feel pressure? Seriously?
For sure.
Sure.
Really?
We had 5 days there, you know. Which...
Oh, man. Wow. Okay. So it's usually a track a day. So you did. Oh, my. Yeah, right. Right. Like the rule for recording is a track a day, right? So, yeah, you guys hustled.
No, yeah. First day, I think it was like one track because it was just setting up the entire day. And then the next day, we got to get 4 in today.
Yeah, there's a little troubleshooting. But, I mean, we did prepare to just like marathon the entire record. And because we knew there was some... We could always take it back to Jazz Cats in Long Beach. But there was... Like, we didn't want to miss any opportunities to...
With that equipment in there. Yeah
to get
that. Yeah, yeah, you have lots of good toys, don't you?
$1,000 guitar, you know.
Yeah, no big deal. What the heck? Come on.
Yeah, it felt like we were really spoiled, but it was like, you know, it's like a kid in a toy store almost. Like,
no, I get it. I get it.
There were some things that's like, wait, I want to play this super rare bass that, you know, was... Yeah.
No, it was
all these
fun
legendary albums, but then you realize, like, but it's not the right sound. Like, it's like we had to kind of control ourselves and really just think, like, what does this need to sound like right now? And you know, we spent our time tone diving, as we like to say, but it was interesting just to see how many possibilities like you discover in the moment and you don't want to waste time. So there's moments where it was frustrating and it was just like, oh, if only we had another week, what that record would be something else.
But we really, I mean, last year was pretty slow for us, you know, after everything that had happened, you know, with our personal stuff, but, you know, I remember leaving, Kobe getting sick, and we had all this time, 3 months pretty much before we could record anything. So it was like, you know, 5 days
using
a week.
The time wisely, yeah.
5 days a week, you know, 5 to 7 hours, depending on what had to be done. And we would, you know, sometimes two of us would meet up at the studio, rehearse for a few hours just on the individual parts, and then the rest of the band would come in. But it was like that for months. I got so tired of that rehearsal spot. But so when we finally got to the studios, the best thing ever.
Yeah. The songs were like almost muscle memory. So like, so we knew we were capable of knocking the performances out, and we could kind of really dig in. And
yeah, so let's just go there. I don't want to harp on this because it seems to be everybody's giant headline, but you did go through enough hell in this band for the next zillion years, you know, having to cancel a tour, and obviously having to cancel a tour now again, and having, you know, the health issues. If you're going to do a record about anxiety and mental problems and darkness and all of that stuff, and get your inner Ian Curtis on and do all that stuff, I guess, you know, it doesn't mean that everything's happy in the end. But I guess it did all add up to a record that you can now look back and go, well, it took an awful lot to get there, but it did kind of work out in the end.
I think we made the best of it. I think it was a positive thing overall, and it made it more fun, you know, just getting... For years, we always said that Kobe was the best musician in the band, so for him to move to guitar was a dream, in my opinion, because he could do so much, and you know, he could you know, take some of the load, I guess. Not to say that Dakota was bad or anything, he wasn't. Dakota just had his own style, and sometimes that could be limiting, you know. But Kobe is the opposite. He could do whatever, you know. So it wasn't that difficult.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs on the outside and songs by others in between.